Okay, the floor is yours. We have microphones because this is being recorded. So please ask your question. State who you are, what your affiliation is, and ask your question, and try to keep it as a question rather than a speech. Over here.
Randy Filer from the City University. You all alluded to the next great challenge, the Mint. If I could ask each of you in one sentence, what would be the one critical reform you would do to bring Mint back into the families?
I think probably the most hopeful single step would be to expand and develop further work enforcement programs connected to child support, where fathers who owe child support get some help in working and paying their judgments, but at the same time, they're subject to oversight and therefore under some structure whereby they have to perform. These programs are not yet ready for prime time. They haven't shown the impacts that we find in the welfare work programs, but they're the best thing we've got so far.
I don't think there is a solution that I can think of that will really fundamentally affect men at the moment. The best thing I can think of, and something I'm working on, when men are incarcerated, it's an opportunity time as well as a time for punishment. And when they come out of prison, many of these men want to change their lives. That's the opportunity time, and we're not taking advantage of it. We need to connect up work and other kinds of socialization programs right at the point they come out, use the parole system to enforce work just as welfare caseworkers enforce work through welfare benefits.
Thank you, Edward Hochman from New York City. Fred Siegel, who is a friend of the Manhattan Institute, wrote in his book, The Future Once Happened Here, about the attitude in the 1960s, particularly under the Lindsay administration, of actually encouraging people to get on welfare rather than to leave welfare. So my first question is there anywhere in government where that attitude exists now that we should actually be trying to get more people on welfare? And secondly, when the Giuliani reforms went into effect and the welfare rolls dropped, there were predictions that the city would become Calcutta with homeless people lining the streets. That didn't happen. So what did happen to that 500,000 or more people who left the welfare rolls?
Let me think. The first question was, remind me what your first question was. That's right. Yeah. I guess the original attitude of the 60s towards expanding welfare and entitlement today would be found among many community groups, particularly in large urban settings where the liberal side of the spectrum has simply not accepted the principles of welfare reform, which really is the end of entitlement, the idea that you now have to do something rather than just be needy in order to get welfare. So there are still plenty of people in New York who assert this. That's where you would find that view. You also find it among some politicians, even though, because they respond to the community groups, even though the electorate is against entitlement. So that's where you'd find it. Your second question had to do with why, what happened to the people who left welfare. Well, I think mostly they went to work, and that means that they're on balance better off, although they would not be hugely better off at first. And that's why we don't see Calcutta, because most of those people still have income and they're able to support themselves. Again, there will be exceptions, but as a rule, most people vastly underestimated the capacity of people to leave welfare and get work. They were, in fact, very able to do it. Many of them were working off the books already, and it was a matter of formalizing that transition.
Just to a brief editorial about that. What few people know about the history of New York, we all know about the Lindsay administration welcoming people on. Almost nobody but Charlie Morris has written about the second term of the Lindsay administration, in which they pioneered many of the things you heard about from Jason, tightened up the front door, did a bunch of other things, and actually began to bring the rolls down. And the second part of your question, the really big question in front of us is, what happens if we were to get into a situation in which the economy didn't have an unemployment rate as low as it's had? Even in this recession, it didn't really go much above 6%. I think that's an open issue for us. Right here.
Hi, Michael Myers of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. I address my question to Jason DePaul to comment on Jason Turner's thought that you have to protect the rest of society from the scourge of the underclass. One way of dealing with poverty is not only taking the mothers and putting them into work, into jobs, but removing the so-called welfare family out of their poor environment. And therefore, the question is there a role for government through subsidy to make sure the family gets jobs, like the young teenagers, to make sure that they get subsidies in terms of middle class areas and communities in terms of housing to get out of the slums and the ghettos and the underclass environment where there's crime and get opportunities to go for school choice, to go to better schools, et cetera?
I can't really address what Jason had in mind because I'm not sure what he means in policy terms of protecting the rest of society. My own sense was that I wanted to see something that would integrate society more economically. That what I felt from the families I followed was just a terrible cultural isolation, which. You know, and one small reflection of that was Jules' comment, well, doesn't everybody get their wages garnished? Another time she said to me, I asked her if somebody that she knew was selling drugs. She said, well, that's every black man's job. You know, I was trying to put myself in Jules' mind. I never got a sense of victimization from her. You know, there was never this sense of I'm kept down by the way. No sense of subjugation in her life. And there wasn't really this sense of thwarted aspiration, you know, that I had wanted to be. When I was young, you know, I asked 100 times, what did you want to be? I wanted to be this, but my life wound up this. There was no sense that she was had been shooting for something that she couldn't get. What I really came away feeling was it just a profound alienation. It goes back to the title of the book, American Dream. They're just, at one point I asked Angie, I said, Angie, you know, it's a big prosperous country out there. What's the matter? Well, it works for millions and millions of people. Why couldn't you get with the program? And she kind of bristled up, and she said, do you think we moved to Milwaukee because there was just so much here for us in Milwaukee, good jobs waiting for us in Milwaukee, some new life waiting? We didn't come here for that. It was just the opposite of the immigrant language. I come here for something. So there's just that great isolation and alienation in their lives. So when I try to think, okay, what do you do with that programmatically, in response to the earlier question about what's one thing you could do, the one policy intervention, this is a small thing. This is not going to solve the whole problem. Let me give you one small thing. The one policy intervention that's had the most robust effects in Milwaukee is from a program called the New Hope Project, and it has to do with providing after-school care for boys. It didn't make any difference for girls, but for boys, the kids who got into this after-school program, it was the statistical equivalent of raising their SATs by 100 points. So that's a good boost. I mean, that, you know, well, who wouldn't do that for their kids? That matters. And I think it's a testament to just how isolated and alone these kids are. It gives them a place to go after school. You know, affluent parents are always talking about how overscheduled their kids' lives are. These kids' lives are unscheduled ever. There's just nothing for them there. So anything that could integrate them into a more, gosh, privileged isn't even it, into a more functional atmosphere, I think, is one light post for us.
Gentleman right there, that first raised his hand.
I'm Jack Rosenthal from the New York Times. Oh. let me address a question to all three of you, if you're willing to take it on. Could you talk about the utility or the benefit of the earned income tax credit?
It's played a major role in raising incomes for people who leave welfare and other low-wage workers. There's no question it has a positive effect on incomes. The greater dispute is about whether it has an effect on going to work. What the EITC is, I should explain, is a subsidy for low wages. If you have wages below a certain level, the IRS will subsidize them with an increment. And you get this increment back from the government even if you don't have other tax obligations. So it's refundable.
A $6 an hour job becomes about a $9 an hour.
Yeah, it's about, for a family with children, the subsidy is as much as 40% on your wages. So it's a big increment. It clearly reduces poverty. However, it's not clear to me that it causes more people to go to work. You might say, well, that would increase the payoff to going to work, and therefore more people would be likely to leave welfare and do it. Some economists think so. I think otherwise, and I can go into the details if you want. I think mostly incentives have little to do with whether people go to work. They have more to do with whether you receive a good income after you go to work. What causes people to go to work mostly is moral and administrative suasion. There has to be some help in the way of child care and otherwise, but there also has to be pressure. There has to be a demand to go to work. That's what people respond to more than they do to the incentives.
Jack, it's a huge part of what the way Angie and Jewel get by amounts to. They get about, because Wisconsin has a generous tax credit that's adjusted for family size, and they both, Angie's got four kids and Jewel has three, so they each get between $4,000 and $5,000 a year. I would disagree with Larry about where I thought you were going to go in terms of when you said the unresolved question. I thought you were going to say is whether or not that money translates into upward mobility. And there is not a lot of evidence one way or the other. What there is suggests that it's kind of a mix. Some of it just goes into furniture around the house, spending splurges, and some of it gets reinvested in cars or to a better school, moving so you can send your kids to a better school. One thing I think of policy direction we might want to do some experimenting with is if there's a way to put some sort of counseling or advising or something, casework with that, so that less of it just went to buying the new bedroom set every year, more of it got channeled into stuff that went upward mobility. It is already doing some of that, but I'd like to find a way to see it do more.
Joe Dolan, Akalis and Bodman Foundations. In the press and various other medium, there's talk about the population left in welfare reform that is a harder and more difficult population that apparently has multiple problems and is apparently more difficult also to move that population off welfare. Could you address that particular population? Is this a myth, or what are your views? Thanks.
The evidence for whether the remaining cases are less employable is actually mixed. Some says that they're not more unemployable. I'm inclined to think there's something to it, that the current cases are probably less employable than those we had 10 years ago. However, it doesn't follow from that that they shouldn't be required to work. In fact, it's the less functional who actually may gain the most from going to work and having to work. That it may be the case that they can't get totally off welfare, that is, that we can't get them off the welfare system and into something that we might call self-reliance or independence of government. But that, in my view, has never been the main goal of welfare reform, and most of those who've pursued the reform have seen that as a secondary to raising work levels. So I think for this less functional population, we should move ahead. They should also be required to work. That's good for them, but we should also be ready to offer support in various kinds, too. Getting off welfare is secondary to functioning in the ways that the society normally expects.
As a shorthand, when we talk about the case, we tend to think the easiest case is left first and then the somewhat less easy and down to the hardest. I don't think it really happened that way. When you pose these new work requirements on, sometimes the hardest cases were the first to leave because they couldn't keep up with the bureaucracy of it. It requires a certain level of functionality to keep your benefits. So I think the exodus from welfare, I agree with Larry that maybe the current caseload is a little bit more disadvantaged than the beginning caseload, but it's certainly not the case by any means that we kind of sorted through these and the easiest ones went first. I mean, some of the most troubled people went first, and we're not entirely sure what became of them.
The bureaucratic problem of combining employment and treatment is no small matter, and that's really what I think Larry was talking about. You'd have to find a way to combine the two, mix the two, and very different disciplines, different administrations, different goals. It's a management difficulty. Right here.
June O'Neill, Baruch College. This is, I guess, primarily for Jason. I was wondering how representative your characters are of those who left welfare in Wisconsin, but also how representative they are of the people more broadly who would have been affected by welfare reform, because that would include those who didn't go on welfare, because welfare caseloads declined not only because people left, but because people didn't go on.
The answer is yes, they're representative, but the question is, what are they representative of? I don't think they're representative, certainly, of all low-income single mothers, and I don't think they're representative of all welfare recipients. I think they're broadly representative of the long-term urban welfare population, and I think that population is the heart of the political debate. I mean, that was what the most cultural and political angst was about, so I think that, so that's largely why I focused on them. This is a question of journalists. If you're trying to tell the story of 9 million people through three, you're not going to succeed perfectly, and it's something I had to deal with a lot. What are they representative of, and what aren't they? Two of the three didn't have high school degree. On paper, would have been more disadvantaged, but yet they out-earned 85% of the people coming off the roll, so they're sort of counterbalanced there. I mean, you could look at Angie and Joel and say, well, gee, they had Angie had four kids out of wedlock, and her father was their father was in prison, and she didn't have a high school degree. So on that hand, she's more disadvantaged. But on the other hand, she earned more. And you kind of toggle that back and forth. I think taken together, they are illustrative, if not representative, as a social scientist would call it. They're illustrative of both the problem, of the effects of the law, and of the possible solutions.
Okay, three questions. Way back there.
Heather Higgins. We're having this discussion, I think, in large measure, listening to all of your stories, because as many people have recognized, the nature of the caseload has changed dramatically over the last 60-plus years, from widows to now single women. And we're having this discussion because, as a society, we have disconnected in this population to a far greater degree than in other populations the idea that marriage and child rearing go together, that their father is a part of the family unit and that children are a part of the father's lives, et cetera. I am curious, because there has been much debate over this, as to what the three of you think are the causal factors in that societal and cultural shift, and the degree to which you are therefore optimistic or pessimistic that we can move back to a reconnection of those ideas.
That's a tough question. Let me say, first of all, that a reason why marriage has declined is the one that Jason Turner mentioned, which is the affluence of the society makes marriage no longer so critical for the survival of women and children as it once seemed to be. And that has freed men. There are other forces, too, like obviously birth control and other things that have allowed couples to control procreation, or at least to have some limits. Because of that, the stigma against unwed pregnancy has declined. I think that's a factor. I would also say that the society is much more divided about the marriage question than it is about employment. A feature of the Wisconsin politics was that neither party made an issue of marriage as a focus of welfare reform efforts. Had they pressed that question, I think it would have been harder to get consensus in Wisconsin as it is in Washington. This would have been much more divisive. I also think that there's movement towards greater focus on marriage as a solution to poverty. The government is now investing serious money, like $200 million, in the development of marriage programs that may be able to promote marriage among unwed parents or preserve marriage among low-income people who are married. Those programs are way back. They're not anywhere near as proven as what we have in the welfare work area, but we are moving towards serious program development and evaluation. I would say we're about where we were 20 years ago in the welfare work area. So it's not going to happen overnight, but there is serious effort involved in trying to promote programs that will allow us to address the marriage question.
I agree with almost everything Larry said, and the only part I would add is when you say how optimistic are you, it's really easy to be pessimistic about the state of marriage in the low-income population, but I don't feel particularly pessimistic. I think in part because of the time in which I came on this into this field in the mid-'80s, I mean, that was pessimism. Everything was bad and getting worse. The non-marital birth rate, poverty, employment rates, wages. I mean, one of the great legacies, I think, of this experience, as imperfect as it is that it did work to some degree, and it rehabilitates just the whole idea that government can do something. I mean, I don't think the marriage proposal is going to solve the problem of marriage in America, but it might make a contribution. And there's just no reason for cheap cynicism about government and social policy anymore.
To that, I'd like to add that I think we've learned through welfare reform the power of suggestion, positive suggestion. So much of welfare recipients deciding to go to work and taking that action had to do with the fact that they had absolutely no authority, no guidance in their lives. Some guidance was given imperfectly through the bureaucracy and the welfare system and the larger society through the media that said you should go to work, and people took action on that. I think if we reestablish the norm, society, the middle class reestablishes the norm and is not afraid to articulate it in various fora, that could have a significant impact as well, although it'll take a long time for it to have for marriage to be reestablished as the norm everywhere.
I agree with that, but I would just point out that to change that norm, we also have to change the norm around divorce among middle class and upper class families too. It's a much deeper embedded issue for all of society here. One final question, John.
John Gardner, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. What fiscal incentives, accountabilities, and punishments work and do not work for the managers of employment systems and welfare reform? We focused on the participants, the workers, the welfare recipients, but for the managers, what have we learned works and does not work?
Got to keep your answer short. I thought I was taking a short question.
I think two things work for them. One is incentives. I think the Wisconsin W-2 system did involve creating performance incentives for managers to achieve the goals set by the government. That's a factor. The other is the desire to achieve the mission, which is something broader, simply to solve the problem. I think most managers in the nonprofit sector are strongly motivated to achieve public goals. Those goals were defined with unusual clarity in this case. And I think most of the agencies were indeed motivated to achieve them. Whether or not they did so is another question.
I can't give you any thoughts about what worked, just because I found such a shocking lack of accountability. So I don't know. Maybe I think what happened in Wisconsin is they privatized, but they didn't supervise. So the non-detailed answer would be that if a state is going to turn over that much authority to other entities, it's got to keep track of what they're doing. I think that failed to happen in Wisconsin.
Let's see if this is.
Keep talking, they'll turn it on.
Okay.
So the short answer is bring back Jason.
I don't know if that's it. I think one of the things we learned in New York and in earlier in Wisconsin is that the bureaucracy is highly highly tuned into the signals that they get from performance standards and contracting. And they're very capable of picking up what the mission is if the performance contracts are properly introduced. We saw the agencies in Milwaukee highly tuned into the idea that they had to get people off of welfare and into work. And as Jason points out correctly, the same idea of making certain that they were in a community service job while they're on welfare was not articulated through the performance standards, and there was an insufficient accountability partly for that reason as well. That's an incomplete answer, but that's all we have time for.